Dr. James Glatfelder is a theoretical physicist turned complexity scientist who's interested in the do's and don'ts when it comes to the really big picture, you know, little questions such as the nature of consciousness, the universe, and reality itself. So not exactly fluff that we're going to be discussing here today. He's also the author of the book that just came out, The Sapient Cosmos, What a Modern Day Synthesis of Science and Philosophy Teaches Us About the Emergence of Information Consciousness and Meaning. James, welcome to the program.
Tata, thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. Absolute pleasure, and I'm really excited about this conversation. First question, what's going on? And by what's going on, I mean, why does everything exist? What a question.
Oh,
no, I'm sorry. Yeah, no, I was kind of walking around today before the interview. Uh-huh. It's a perfectly nice day, but I suddenly had one of these like strange feelings, probably because I knew that we're going to be having a conversation, that it's also bizarre that everything exists and all, and I didn't know what to do with it because I never do. Maybe to be a bit more specific, it just feels so odd and overwhelming sometimes, the story as it stands now, you know, like the Big Bang, the laws of physics and time appearing, and this little planet in the corner of the universe struck with life, followed by millions of years of evolution, countless catastrophes, so that you and I now are here experiencing these feelings and having zero ideas about what to do with them, at least in my case. But I guess that's what we're going to be talking about today.
I mean, what you're addressing is it's interesting that most of us get up in the morning and are totally like nonchalant about the craziness of existence and like all the like coincidences and everything that had to happen, because as Leibniz asked, like, why is there something and not nothing? Because nothing seems so much easier. And it depends, like, sort of from which cultural context you're looking at it, because from the Western scientific physicalist context, it's like, yeah, it just happened, so deal with it. There's no purpose. It's random. It's just you're here and, like, just stop asking these stupid questions. But from many other cultures who were, like, deeper into sort of experiencing their own consciousness, I like to, like, call the shamans, the mystics, the meditators, and the psychonauts who, like, really go inside and try and figure out what's happening inside, which apparently gives you insights to what's happening around. And yeah, they have a very different perception of what's going on. So there seems to be this intelligence behind the things we see in the physical universe, and this intelligence has a purpose. And again, depending on what cultural context, the Hindus have this concept of Leela, where if you're, so there's only the self that exists. This is the cosmic consciousness, which is great because that's all there is. And it's unified, it's perfect, but it's also really boring because there's no context. There's nothing to be experienced. So what the self does, it hides itself so it can find itself. And this is kind of the grand play we're in. So we're kind of enacting this illusion of being separate, but all of us and everything is part of this self, this unified consciousness. But just to have something happen, you need to have duality. So you need good and bad and light and shadow and tears and laughter. But it's not as in kind of this Leela context, it's not to be taken too seriously because you're an actor. And I think that's kind of very sort of reframing for a lot of things that we in the West kind of worry about and suffering and all these things, like, why did this happen? Well, yeah, it could be that this is just sort of the thing that created everything trying to experience all the experiences that can be made. So I don't know. But I do feel that there's more purpose out there than we are kind of led to believe in this physicalist metaphysical doctrine or dogma that we grew up in as sort of scientifically thinking people. And only now we're kind of discovering that this is more of a dogma than something science tells us. And it's very scientific to say, hey, perhaps it's not material, the universe, but it's based on consciousness. And this is kind of the renaissance we're seeing in the philosophy of mind.
Well, yeah, today I had enough of it. So I was just like, it would be much easier to just be a medieval peasant, you know? Yes, life was brutal, but you didn't know that it's brutal. Also, things were really straightforward. There, you just knew that there's a God that created everything. And if you're a good person, you're going to go to heaven. And if you're a bit of a piece of shit, you're going to go to hell. No crisis of meaning whatsoever. But yeah, I already have like a million questions. But I suppose the one strain of scientific thought right now that I hear a lot is that this question that we're asking as humans, why, is just because we're a storytelling animal, as they say, and that the universe is just indifferent to this question. We need to know because evolution kind of embedded this necessity to ask why in order for us to survive. It was a smart strategy, but now it's kind of redundant and irrelevant to the universe. So it has nothing to do with the objective truth.
But is it though? Because maybe the universe unfolding is a huge narrative, and there's a teleology. So the universe has a purpose, and it's going to some place which apparently is more complexity and more structure and more creativity. So depending on how you look at it, I mean, this is the disenchanted view that I find science and dogmatic religion brings to life, where you just look around and it's either random, has no purpose, it's sad, you just die, or you have this external authority which is outside of space and time, but which tells you like what is correct or what how you have to live. And I find these are both very disenchanted ways of looking at life, and it's also a Western thing that we are not kind of taught to sort of be mindful and more spiritual in the sense of working with our own consciousness, because this only came to the Western mind like 200 years ago with Schopenhauer was the first Western person to sort of look at the Upanishads and the Vedas and Hinduism and Buddhism and bring it to the West. And there it's very clear that you find the purpose by looking inside. So it's very much the Western world looking outside, finding answers, which gets you really far. We have math, which is the machine code of reality, and we can do alien technology, crazy technology. But then apparently, because we missed some part of like what's going on, we end up being this terrible collective consciousness which destroys the planet that keeps us alive, which seems very paradoxical. Like, why are humans individually so super smart, but collectively we're like dumb as fuck? Sorry. Like, we're instigating the sixth mass extinction, the ecocide. And then you look at termites, who are like super stupid, each one individually, but as a collective, they start to build ventilation shafts and cultivate fungus gardens and behave super intelligently. So the question becomes like, first of all, what's intelligence? Where does it come from individually and collectively? And why are we so smart individually, but so weird as a collective that we have set up a world which seems to be so cruel? So many people are struggling. There's like, it's getting worse every year. Like, everyone feels the edge. How can that be? And I would claim it's exactly that, like, this Western template of looking at reality has just taken over the world, which is fine, but we should just remember that this is one way of looking at things. So exactly saying that there's an objective reality out here, that's already a metaphysical statement, which we don't really know, because we're all locked in consciousness. The only thing I know is my consciousness. Everything else is derived. So everything I see appears on this screen of consciousness, but it's a step further out. So I don't know anything about the external world, because I can't. I can only see it filtered through my consciousness. Which then, yeah, if you're open for more philosophical ideas, how do I know anything exists? Is this a dream? Do you exist? Solipsism, is everything just happening in my mind? Is this a simulation? There's no way we can prove or disprove any of this. And that's where the Western mind seemed to have like drifted off, that it started to be bad in metaphysics or very naive, because it was like, hey, the universe, it's 400 years ago, it made sense. Like Newton and Leibniz, they were like, hey, it's a clockwork universe. If you look at the little parts, you can understand the big parts. It's all deterministic. It's predictable. We understood. we found the code of the universe. And even with quantum mechanics coming in like 1905 and just blatantly telling us there is no fundamental physical reality. If you go to the fundamental level of reality, it makes no sense. It's incoherent. It's illogical. But that never got integrated into the philosophy or kind of the metaphysical assumptions, because most scientists at the time were like, shut up and calculate this, just this weirdness. Don't even bother about it. We don't understand, but we have the math and it works. And without the math, we can do quantum computing and all crazy stuff. So why bother with these metaphysical crazy question of what it means? But it appears that we've kind of reached a phase also in theoretical physics where not much has happened in terms of progress. So we had string theory, which was the attempt of like, hey, gravity and quantum forces, like, how do you bring them together? Quantum gravity doesn't work. But string theory was like this attempt of, wow, 11 dimensions, M theory, these membranes, whatever, which was nice. It gave us a lot of math, like in topology and stuff, but it didn't give us anything tangible about what the universe is. And that's kind of the point, that science tells us what reality, no, how it works. Science is the how, but the what is not in the purview of science. This is, by definition, metaphysics, which belongs to philosophy. What is the nature of reality? This is not a scientific question. The scientific question is, how does reality unfold according to whatever laws you have or whatever is the initial conditions and the dynamics? That's science, but it's the what it is. And we're slowly realizing that this is kind of a big deal, which in 1994, David Chalmers, when he kind of shocked or rocked the boat of the philosophy of science, where he came up with the higher problem of consciousness. Which actually, I mean, he wasn't the first to say this, but he kind of really sort of placed it in the spotlight, saying, how do you get non-conscious stuff to become conscious? Like, how does that work? How do you get something which is inherently not conscious and you put it together and suddenly this inner perspective, your window into reality emerges? How is this possible? So, yeah, there's two answers on a huge spectrum. One answer is from these more materialistic thinking philosophers of mind who are like, yeah, consciousness isn't such a big deal. It's kind of an illusion. There's no free will. You're making a big deal out of it. It's probably like stage magic. Once you understand how the trick's done, you'll be very disappointed. So don't worry. The hard problem isn't really a problem. And then you have the other guy saying, well, one solution to the hard problem is that maybe everything comes out of consciousness, and consciousness is the ontological primitive, the foundation. You can't go any deeper. And in between, you like have 200 other different theories of mind, of consciousness in the philosophy of mind, showing us how bad our academic understanding of consciousness is. We still even don't have a definition. We like have Thomas Nagel's What It Feels Like to Be a Bat, where what is consciousness? Well, consciousness is if it feels like to be something, which is a terrible definition, but kind of the most universally used, because there's no one kind of came up with a definition that everyone liked or could work with. So, yeah, the question is, but that doesn't make any sense. How can everything be consciousness? That's kind of stupid. But then you realize, actually, that was the lived reality of most people, most cultures, always, except the West.
Are you talking about a form of panpsychism?
So, yes.
Because I just recently had Philip Goff on the podcast, and we did talk about that.
So, panpsychism is like the first attempt to be more radical in the metaphysics, where it's like, okay, it's not possible that consciousness is just this emergent phenomenon which happens in brains. It must be something more fundamental. So panpsychism says, well, consciousness is kind of everywhere. It's sort of it's like the magic dust. It's distributed.
Yeah, he called it the building block of the universe, I believe.
Yep. And it's like an additional. So if you have an electron, it has mass, it has spin, it has electric charge, and it has a bit of consciousness already there, built in. So that's the idea of panpsychism, that consciousness is like distributed and you find little degrees of it. And if you put stuff together, then it becomes like more conscious. But this is actually one of the tricky parts of panpsychism. And there's like very technical ways of explaining it. The unification problem. So if every electron has a bit of consciousness, or every atom, how do you bring these all together that they have one unified experience of consciousness? And I'm not sure what Philip Goff, what his current answer to this would be, but there's like very technical ways of understanding this. But I find, like, if you're starting to go down the rabbit hole, why not go just to the very end? And that would be idealism, which says it's not you have physical stuff with mental properties. There's only mental properties. That's it. So everything physical is derived and emerges from this fundamental field of consciousness, which, again, many people have written about forever. The shamans, the mystics, the meditators, and the psychonauts. If you read, like, I don't know, Michael Pollan David, I think, Pinchbeck, Breaking Open the Head, where they describe their DMT experiences. And then you realize that this is something that shamans have been like accessing for 30, 50,000 years. And yeah, the mystics, some people just spontaneously sit by a river and it just hits them and they understand how the universe works. And the claim is always that there is this, obviously, like for the mystics, it was God, the divine. But more in contemplative traditions, like in Hinduism and Buddhism, it's more about this cosmic consciousness. It isn't framed as a, like a divine thing, a God. It's more something which is just the substrate of things that exist, and you can access it by meditation. So if you go to the very end, like this one, a monk was saying, yeah, in science, you like zoom in and try and find like the tiniest building block. Well, in meditation, you try and do the same inwards. And kind of when you reach the end of your introspection, that's where you start to come into contact with this unified consciousness, apparently. So now the question is, should we take this seriously, or are these just like deluded hallucinations? And that's where we're slowly progressing with the psychedelic renaissance, where we now have the philosophy of psychedelics, where people are like, what if these are not deluded hallucinations? What if these reality layers we can access through our consciousness, which are outside of time and space? What if this is somehow telling us something about the structure of reality? And yeah, slowly we're open in the West to discussing these things and being more radical.
Back to consciousness, just for a second there. You did say that we don't even have a definition of consciousness yet. But I did have, again, my reference here is a guest, Anil Seth, the renowned consciousness researcher, who I'm sure you're familiar with.
Yes.
So his theory is that consciousness is a sort of an illusion and actually a consequence of our brains being what he calls prediction machines. He writes about it in the book called Being You. So he argues that the mind has been conditioned by evolution to always try to predict what's going to happen next, in the very next moment. And this gives rise to the sort of illusion, he calls it, of a coherent experience that we describe as being
exactly
conscious.
Exactly, that would be the physicalist point of view.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, totally. And all of this to say, like you said, that you know, he and many others think that physicalism is the way to go forward and will give eventually the key to unlock the hard problem of consciousness. We really don't need anything else.
Which makes a lot of sense, because that's the paradigm we were brought up in. So kind of seeing beyond this is really hard for many people, because it's like, yeah, you invest, it's a bit, I'm not like suggesting that necessarily he is, but for a lot of like scientifically minded people, it is a bit dogmatic that you kind of invested a lot in a belief and you're not kind of very happy if people challenge it. But the problem now with, okay, Anil Seth, he's like a very famous, visible neuroscientist. So he brings a theory which makes sense. And then you have Carhart Harris, who started with David Nutt to do imaging, neuroimaging from people under psychedelics, and they come up with this hypothesis. No, it's actually, it's entropy, the entropic brain theory. And again, this is a clever person. And the problem is that last year, I think David Kuhn, he's called, he wrote a paper sketching the landscape of all these theories, and he listed at least 200 different theories of what consciousness could be, from the materialists, from Anil Seth, from Carhart Harris, the entropic brain, to all the way to idealism. So it's kind of a weird situation where, if you think, but somehow every clever person has their own like pet theory they like, somehow we're still far off the mark of understanding what's going on here. Because you would think if there's like a truth emerging, that more people would gravitate around that and sort of be drawn into that. But it doesn't seem to be happening. It's still like totally fragmented. And like every clever person has their theory of what consciousness is. Is it that? Is it, yeah, the entropy, or is it kind of the whatever, the microtubuli and like these quantum effects, or so. And that's kind of the reason why I believe that people have gotten a bit sort of tired of like, yeah, we're going to understand it one day because we know how the universe works. There's four forces. We know them. So we have to understand it. Just be cool. It'll work out. We'll one day, yeah, David Dennett, it's a bag of tricks. It's stage magic. One day we'll understand and it'll be like totally underwhelming and everyone would be like, oh, wow, okay, that's consciousness. Huh. Yeah, wasn't a big deal. But I doubt this is happening. And I also tie it together to what's happening in fundamental physics, that there's no progress. In 30 years, we have made no progress in like expanding our understanding. And my claim is that we are not mine. I mean, this is a claim I've kind of taken over from other people who I think are going in the right direction. And it's, we are limited by a metaphysical belief system, which we until very recently didn't even realize was a metaphysical belief system, because we thought that's like science. That's if you're against physicalism, you're anti-science, you're being irrational and being silly. And only slowly we're realizing, actually no, because these are metaphysical questions. What is consciousness? This is again like the thing, what it is and not how it works. Like, how does consciousness work? The easy problem, which is also hard, but the thing, what it is, and we need to have philosophical discussions. And this is the problem that started like the second generation of quantum physicists with the Shut Up and Calculate, where they were really like, hey, philosophy is a huge waste of time because there's like, you can discuss forever. There's no correct answer. And I think this is a blind spot that we are slowly discovering, that we really need to evaluate our own metaphysical beliefs, because this shapes how we interact and see reality. And this is really important. And realizing maybe it's correct. Maybe physicalism is correct and everything else is like just whatever, wishful thinking and silly. But it's still important to know that this is a belief I hold, which is not rational. Physicalism is as irrational as it is to be panpsychist or idealist, because none of these positions can be proven or disproven. They are metaphysical intuitions. But the physicalists say, no, ours is clear. Ours is the right one because of the objective reality and stuff. But then again, like, hey, quantum physics is telling us there is, the reality is not rational. Common sense is not there. And it's totally illogical. You have so many quantum phenomena that are so weird and getting weirder. You like, I mean, nowadays people who are working like with quantum information, they're saying, actually, to the idea that an elementary particle has some objective property because before you measure it makes no sense. I mean, come on, people saying that, it's like, how can you still be so confident in your physicalism when reality at the fundamental level is telling you it's wave particle, depends how you measure it. It's tunneling. It can be there or there. It's all probabilities. And now people are like saying maybe space-time is emergent as well, emerging from quantum, entangled quantum information. So if someone tells me space-time is not fundamental, I find this idea of this objective, physical, common sense reality, it seems to be very naive. And something that that seems wishful thinking. And confronted with all these like issues we're seeing in fundamental physics, we're not understanding consciousness from a scientific perspective. Maybe we need to open up and think of more radical stuff and test these ideas. And this is slowly beginning to happen. And that we realize that actually the things that we're now open to is a wisdom that other cultures, most cultures spanning the world, have always had access to, always, except the Western rational mind, which is funny that we're only kind of remembering. Just an example like this, this hostility towards altered states of consciousness, the war on drugs and all of these things. The Vedas, they had this god Soma, which was very prominent in the Vedas, which was also a psychedelic drink. Plato in Greece around the same time, they had these Eleusinian mysteries, which were these mystical traditions which lasted for 1,000 years, which everyone who was anyone went there once a year. And they were drinking kaikion, which to a high probability of people who are studying it, like Hoffman, who the LSD guy, or Stanislav Grof, who are into this psychedelics kind of research, are like, this was psychedelic. And Plato partook in these rituals. So Western philosophy, more or less, is based or was heavily influenced by psychedelics, which I don't hear anyone tell anyone ever in any philosophy class. So there's, I think, a lot of things. So the Western mind was awesome, like with the rational looking outwards, and we got really, really far. But I think now we kind of reached this crisis of like meaning. What do we do now? We have rovers on Mars. We AI. Have supercomputers. Yeah. We have crazy clever AI. What do we do now? And now it seems to be we have this global psychosis where people are just like not knowing what the point of anything is. And I blame like religion and this physicalism for this sentiment, this disenchanted way of, as you said, not waking up in the morning like, oh my God, this is crazy. This is crazy. Look at all the structures, the clouds. This is amazing. No, really. I mean, we should all be like in awe.
I'm laughing because it's so familiar to me that I'm like, yeah. Why is everybody not screaming at the top of their lungs 24/7?
Exactly. And everyone's like, oh, my bus is late. Oh, my job sucks. My kids are annoying. And yeah, we're kind of so caught up in I don't know, kind of this rat race of having to pay rent and stuff, that we just often do not take the time to like reflect on what the hell is going on here. It's crazy, insane.
By the way, I did ask Anil Seth about psychedelics, and he's pretty much said that, yeah, we looked at, you know, brain scans of people under various psychedelic drugs. And we found pretty much what we would expect to find, which is like different regions of the brain firing and thus producing. I probably butchered it, but that's what I understood. And thus producing like wildly different experiences than in normal waking state, you know. So it was just like you still have a brain that's producing these experiences, and the brain is still a material thing.
Bernardo Kastrup, he's a computer scientist turned philosopher of mind. And he's like super hardcore idealist. And he really challenges these studies because there's quotes from like the early studies from like this Carhart-Harris and these people who are like, oh, wow, this is actually strange, because we expected like the firework. We expected like, because it's clear when you take psychedelics, your phenomenal experience is just amplified like crazy. You are making so you're just experiencing so much more. You're in this transcendental tunnel of like craziness. But if you look at the brain, many regions are actually have less metabolic activity going on, which seems to be very weird. And then they like come up with, yes, it's like the entropy, the noise. And then at the end of the day, it's like really tiny differences they're measuring. And the claim still is, but if it's consciousness, if the brain creates consciousness and your consciousness enhances, why don't you like overall see more crazy activity, which you don't? Or like this one guy who went to the doctor in France, he was 42, he had a pain in his leg, which then was published in The Lancet, one of the most famous or the most prestigious medical journals.
Yeah,
exactly. And they analyzed him and they found that he had like 80 or 90% of his brain missing. It was just fluid. He had kids. I mean, he wasn't like the brightest guy, but he functioned. He had a family. He had his job. And the question there is like, how does that work? Like, how is the thing that should be producing consciousness, which he didn't have, because it was literally just a small part that was actually kind of developed as a brain and the rest was like fluid. How can he still like work like that? Or accidental savants, like you jump into a pool and it's too shallow and you hit your head, you have head trauma, and afterwards you're a prodigy piano player. Or you start to like have crazy creative artistic kind of capabilities where you think, how does making the brain worse by destroying parts of it make the consciousness better? So there is a lot of stuff which is in conflict to a kind of a very sort of narrow materialistic of like neurons firing consciousness. So there does seem to be, or like near death experiences, which are being like more and more studied, and they seem to be cross cultural, the same stuff happening. But again, you can explain it away by saying, yeah, of course, it's like the brain is doing these last sort of computations or whatever, which then lead to these experiences. But this is not what people experience. People experience very deeply, deep, profound, often mystical experiences, which changes their life afterwards, and they're not afraid of death anymore, which seems kind of weird. And again, like, so for me, it's I find psychedelics really interesting. I mean, first of all, they're like super dangerous. Not everyone should take them. They're crazy.
Unnecessary disclaimer here. Yes.
Very, very important. Yeah. But if you come in and tell me, look, there's only physical stuff. There's no way that anything non-physical can exist. There's no free will, because we know there's four forces in the universe. So your consciousness isn't one of them. So if you think you are having free will, this is an illusion. It's not happening. There's only physical stuff. I would really like to challenge such a person to smoke DMT, to take ayahuasca, to take a high dose of LSD, and then have the discussion afterwards. Like, did you have an experience in your consciousness which happened outside of space and time? I would claim everyone is like, yes, that happened. What does this tell you? How real did it feel? What do many psychonauts say? The experience there, although it's so crazy, and it's like so, I don't know how to call it. It defies anything, any category of experience you ever had. But they say that feels more like home. That feels more real than this reality, which I find the most craziest statement you can make. And again, it's like, depending on who you are from a physicalist or not perspective. So the philosophy of psychedelics, Leatherby, I forget his first name, he's a philosopher of psychedelics, and he wrote one of the first books actually called The Philosophy of Psychedelics before it became more of a thing. And he was saying that, yes, we know that psychedelics have benefits for mental health. Like, there's efficacy there. We know that. But this comes at a high price, because it instills a very silly metaphysical belief in these people. Idealism. They start to think that consciousness is behind everything. Oh, this is so bad. I mean, it heals them, but then they have these crazy ideas about reality, which are wrong. And I'm like, how can you be so certain? How can anyone be certain about anything as long as I can like deny reality with solipsism, which cannot be theoretically or empirically challenged? If I can say it's only my mind and that's it. There's nothing no one can ever do to change my mind. So how can you have certainty in such, like, if you're really being intellectually honest, you would have some degree of like, I don't know, maybe this isn't all of it. Maybe there's more layers to it. Maybe there's different dimensions to it. But then if as a kid you've been like, I don't want to say indoctrinized, that sounds a bit harsh, but just being exposed to like, no, this is how the universe works. We know it from science. Then, of course, that's how you grow up. I mean, if you grow up in a very strict religious family, you most probably for a while will be very entrenched in that one religion and be very certain that that's the correct way of looking at reality and that's the correct God.
You were trained as a scientist and you went that route. When did it start kind of like cracking for you, all of this stuff?
So at 15, I met a teacher who introduced me to chemistry.
Okay. Like, I was afraid you were going to say who introduced me to psychedelics. So that would be kind of rough.
No, yeah. That happened a couple of years later.
At 16.
That messed with me as well. So yeah, that's why disclaimers.
We've all been there. Yeah.
And that was like, wow, this is amazing. Like, we can know so much. And then it was like, but actually chemistry is explained by quantum physics. Like the bonding stuff, the angles, this is all electron orbitals. And I was like, oh my God, this is insane. I need to study physics at 15. Because if I study physics, I'll know how everything works. And this was like something I was really invested in. I wanted to know, well, how does this universe work? So I went to study theoretical physics. I finished studying theoretical physics. And I was like, damn, that didn't help because it's no answers, more questions. This is really weird. We like, oh, wow. And then during my PhD, I started to, complexity theory it's also a bit of a challenge to the materialist, physicalist ideology, if I can call it that, because this emergence, why does this, it's more holistic. The sum of the parts are literally more, and you really have these weird phenomena which opens up to, yeah, you're a bit more open. So
okay, just a second, if I can interrupt just for a little bit, can you just give me like a rundown of a complexity theory, like for dummies?
Okay, so science works really well for things you can put into equations. I mean, equations are the machine code of reality. And it works super well from the subatomic to cosmology. Where it doesn't work so well is when there's complexity. So when there's a lot of stuff happening. So if you have a swarm of birds, how do you model that? How does that work? Or if you have termites or traders in a market, the stock market, how can you understand this? And then you realize that equations aren't really helping there because you can't sort of, yeah, they're just too many or you can't solve them.
But so kind of again, instead of zooming in, you're zooming out a little bit. Is that what we're saying?
In the sense you're kind of changing the lens you're looking through.
Right.
So instead of looking through it through math, you realize, hey, algorithms, you try and model the system. You're saying, okay, what's next? And you're taking your complex system and you're throwing it on a network. So suddenly you have a structure, the network structure, the topology, which gives you information of the system. And you don't care if the node is a neuron, a bird in a swarm, or a trader in a market. What you're now looking at is the interaction structure. And this is where you can start to see patterns and understand more. And one nice thing in complexity theory, simple rules lead to complex behavior, which is great because otherwise we wouldn't understand stuff so well. So studying complexity theory kind of opens you up a bit to being more open to, yeah, sort of holistic stuff, that it's not just, you don't just reduce it, somehow it's more connected. And that's where I, yeah, sort of started to write about this stuff. My first book that came out in 19, which I started in 13, which it began as an appendix of my thesis and kind of grew. And then it was like, okay, like, what do we know here? And realizing that consciousness, the thing you would think is the first thing you would want to study, is something which is really badly understood. And then going just deeper down the rabbit hole, realizing that it seems to be that you have these two, or there's different ways you can access knowledge, which already is like challenging the physicalist view, which says, no, there's only one way, rational logic. But there seems to be, next to rational knowledge, experiential knowledge, where you take DMT, you go to this place, you come back, or during ayahuasca, which is like very deeply trauma releasing, and people like have the most craziest like experiences which help them kind of deal with the traumas they were working with. So this is a very different kind of knowledge than you would have if you sit together with a psychiatrist or a psychologist. So these two things, and I kind of realized that experiential knowledge is very important as well. And experiential knowledge is wider because it can deal with, you can understand things which you cannot understand rationally, like this idea of non-duality, which is also from the Vedas, Advaita, which rationally makes no sense. Come on, it's silly. You have the object and the subject. You can't tell me that they fuse and become one thing. This is really silly. That's not rational. But you can experience this in meditation or ego death in psychedelics, when suddenly your sense of identity dissolves and you become everything, which sounds very silly. And you cannot know what this means unless you've had the experience. And my claim here would be that idealism is something which we cannot understand rationally. What does it mean that everything is consciousness? Come on, that's just like some hippie, whatever, new agey stuff. But yeah, this is something which you can experience, and experience from very different perspectives and kind of methods you can get there. And these things have been written about for many, many, many millennia. And there's maybe the idea that we need to be more plural and diverse in our way, how we access knowledge, that it's not just one narrow thing. And also, it's not just sober waking consciousness, which is just one tiny slice in this apparently huge multiverse of pure experience, which you can go and visit and discover stuff in, and it's there to be explored. But we only say, hey, sober waking consciousness, everything else is deluded hallucination. And again, these are cultural things which shape our worldview and which shape our whole world. And I believe that many of these things are dysfunctional, don't function anymore, and lead to the terrible, terrible situation we're in today, where just, I think most people would say that this is crazy, the world we have created. This, my brain is full of microplastics because, yay, we have huge garbage patches in the Pacific, in the Atlantic. I mean, this is just like an insanity. We're like insane as a collective. But as individuals, we're all like, no, you know, and we're very rational, and we're clever, and we know, we're just sort of looking at the world and trying to understand it. So I find there's like a lot of improvement that we can, that are like accessible to us.
Just devil's advocate, just a little bit.
Uh-huh.
I did hear a lot of these like Silicon Valley types say, you know, that they love psychedelics and stuff, but they don't strike me as the most moral people out there. You know, like Steve Jobs famously said, yeah, he was into LSD and so forth. I just wonder, does, you know, taking a bunch of psychedelics and then feeling one necessarily precipitate that you're going to come back and have a more moral, if that's the right word I'm looking for, kind of sense of the world? Because it seems like a lot of these guys don't, you know, it's exactly what you said. Let's just invent more stuff that we can sell to more people.
I fully agree with you. And that's the problem with integration. So just like having this one experience of like, oh, wow, I'm everything. That's not enough. You really have to integrate that into your life and continue maybe with more mindfulness. So I know like two people who had these epiphanies, like this sense of unification. And they were like, oh my God, you cannot even imagine what I experienced, the love behind everything. I was just love, everything. It's amazing. And they continued to live their life very selfishly. Which I'm like,
I know a couple of people like that too. They did ayahuasca and then they went on and being complete toads to everybody else in their life.
How does that work? But I believe this is just kind of the whole context is messed up. Like why you did it, how you did it, how you integrate. And again, it's like not easy. But if you do it the right way, I believe there is potential for transformation. But again, you can have this transformation, this spirituality, any other way. You can meditate, for instance, which just takes really long. I don't know, neuroscience of meditators. I think like if you meditate 30 minutes a day for 3 months, you can start to see structures changing in your brain, which you can functionally, which you can MRI, whatever, and see. Or like these 60,000 hour meditators, who have Jesus. Totally different response to startling, to pain, to... So you literally can rewire your brain just by contemplation, by... So it's your consciousness which is rewiring your brain, which would seem to be like free will, no?
When you talk about integration, what exactly do you mean here? Do you mean that you have to kind of follow a certain spiritual tradition?
What do you mean by integration? So yeah. I think it's what these psychedelic assisted therapies are all about, where they really, so the psychedelic part is just about resetting your brain in a sense, because I believe that's what people are talking about when they, or the mental health benefits. You're stuck in your thinking. You cannot move by a millimeter because you're just in this tight space in your thinking. When you take psychedelics, it's like a reboot, and suddenly there's more flexibility in your thinking. You have more possibilities of how you look at reality. And this seems to be some of the, like one of the benefits, but that's the start. It's like loosening, opening up, and then the therapy starts from there. And again, that can be a long journey. So that seems to be sort of just having like this one, like, breaking open the head experience is the start to a longer journey. And if you don't go on that journey, it was just like, yeah, some carnival you went to and had a great experience and that was it. And it's not meaningful in any way.
What was your experience with psychedelics?
So when I was 17, my friend started like discovering LSD and I was like, oh, amazing. Sounds so cool. I'd read Aldous Huxley, super psyched, went with a friend as a sitter to the forest. A friend of mine gave me a tab of LSD with a Buddha on it. Like, ooh, it's very strong. I was like, ooh, respect. So I took half of it. After 45, 50 minutes, I didn't feel any effects. So being a stupid teenager with my friend, the only solution we came up with is you need to take the second part of the LSD tab as well, which I did. And then the first part kicked in and then the second part kicked in. And I don't really know. It was just too much. I took too much. So it was very incoherent.
Heroic dose.
Yeah. It was very interesting. Yeah, but nothing. I mean, it was very disappointing. The next day, I was like, well, that was a bummer. I totally expected something different.
So no, like, tripping, no swimming in space.
No, I mean, I was just more or less, I don't know, unconscious. I mean, I didn't really have that many sort of memories coming back. But what did happen after a month, I started to have panic attacks for 2 years. So my rationale was like, I was too young and this psychedelic experience was too violent that it messed me up in a way that kind of panic attacks were some valve to get rid of this. So yeah, psychedelics are very potent and dangerous.
And then later on, you didn't revisit.
Just like, I don't know, with psilocybin or microdosing a bit or... THC, so that's kind of the thing I find very therapeutic and it helps. And actually, I'm in a study in Switzerland where I can now legally buy weed in the pharmacy because they have a 3-year trial to figure out what happens if weed is legalized. How do we deal with it? And so, yeah, that seems to be happening. And I find that I've had like semi-mystical experiences with THC. Yeah. So,
yeah, I've dabbled a little bit as well, but I definitely want to do some more. I did some psilocybin.
Yeah,
that was pretty crazy. Also, once therapeutic. I always hated when people are like, "Oh, yeah, it helped me deal with this and that," and I was just like, "Oh, that's some hippie bullshit," you know, like just do psychotherapy. What are you doing? And then it happened to me, and it really helped me deal with. But it was really strong. I couldn't say that it was a pleasant trip at all. It was really concentrated, and a lot of stuff came to the surface. Yeah, it's a bit of a violent experience, but definitely felt better after. It was all said and done.
Did you then, was it a one-off or did you like continue a bit for like in a more sort of exploratory or?
No, then I was just, like you said, like a Luna Park, you know, I just did it a couple of more times with friends and had an amazing time and still have lots of fond memories. But never in a more like serious sort of way. Also, I don't think I ever did it alone. It always scared me.
I just remembered to finish the story how I got into the more like open-minded stuff. So during the PhD, I had to take a course outside of the field of study I was doing. So you always had to like do courses every semester. And I took an introductory course into the philosophy of science. And that just blew my mind because I'd never really sort of thought about these things very seriously. And I found that quite shocking that only now, at the end of my PhD, I get exposed to these ideas. Like how is it not a thing that every scientist or at least physicist has a little course on the philosophy of science? What is the law of nature? How do you know that? Like, what is induction and why did Hume say that induction doesn't work at all? What is reality? What is metaphysics? Why? What is ontology? What are these things talking about? How do I know stuff? Epistemology. And that was when I realized, wow, this is really bad that this is so kind of segregated. And then I found a lot of quotes from like very big famous influential physicists like Stephen Hawking or Freeman Dyson, Feynman, who like spoke really, really badly of philosophers, like really deriding them and like, you're a silly bunch of dwarves compared to like the philosophers back of. And I was like, that seems very weird that you wouldn't think this is important. You're a physicist, you want to know how reality works. How can you like totally exclude these philosophical questions of like, yeah, but what even is reality? Like, let's start there before we then jump into the equations. And that's when I realized that there's these huge blind spots in our Western like view on reality, which appear to be hindering the process. So we got really far. And now we're kind of stuck with our understanding of consciousness and fundamental physics. And that's why people are realizing we need to try new stuff. And that's why we see the renaissance of idealism in the philosophy of mind. Who would have guessed? I mean, the German idealists, they were told they should stop being silly and stop doing this stupid philosophy by the American analytical philosophers, Bertrand Russell, who were very like, you have to be very clear with your philosophy and don't be silly. And idealism is very silly, you Germans. And now we have a renaissance of where they're very serious, sober, clever people, like laying out what idealism could mean. Miri Albahari, she's an Australian professor of philosophy, and she wrote her version of idealism, which builds on the knowledge of the mystics. And it's really, really hard to read because it's a super hardcore philosophy text. I'm not trained as a philosopher. So like every page takes like 5 minutes to understand because she really goes into what could this mean? Like witness consciousness. What does it mean if you have a field of consciousness that doesn't have a perspective, an aperspectival, unified, like all these very highly rational concepts she's using to try and describe what this could be about. Again, I find it's pretty hard to access, and it's probably easier if you just dive into transcendence by whatever means you like best. You can do drumming or do holotropic breathing, whatever. But then you probably understand more of what idealism could be than reading these texts. But just to show, they're very clever scholars who are very serious, and they're not new age hippies or trying to push some spiritual agenda, who are like, look at this. This seems to be answering a lot of questions of, or answering a lot of the problems that we currently are experiencing.
You seem to be drawn to mysticism and to a lot of these Eastern religious traditions. What's wrong with like the mainstream Western religions, the big three monotheistic religions, for example? They seem to have answers, no?
Yeah. I mean, just historically, the Vedas were the first place where these ideas of consciousness and spirituality started. So that's kind of interesting that you had these rishis, these mystics in the forest who no one really knows who they were, who started to like channel or talk about these crazy concepts, which still today are valid, like cosmic consciousness, all these things already started there. And it's interesting that the Abrahamic religions all had their mystical traditions. You have Gnostics in Christianity, you have the Sufis in Islam, and you have Kabbalah in Judaism. And all of these mystical traditions were very clear. It's about experiencing the divine in your consciousness. And this is what it was about. You try and find this connection, this personal experience of God. But this is not something you can use if you want to institutionalize and have a power structure, because then you need the external authority telling you what is right and wrong. So I think that's where it went wrong. If they would be more open or have more visible mystical traditions in the Abrahamic religions, I think that would help us, would help our spirituality a lot. And I feel that's what many people who are maybe semi-atheistic are like, wow, this personal experiential dimension, that could be something I could relate to. But just having this dogmatic, static worldview, which was written whenever years ago, and it can't move a millimeter because it can't evolve by the definition. This seems to be something which is very bad for a knowledge system if it can't change. So that's, and again, the mystical part is your experiences, which, yeah, can change over time, which are more dynamic.
Slovenian philosopher Slavoj Žižek, I'm from Slovenia, he calls himself an atheist Christian these days. No, a Christian atheist. It's the other way around. And part of it is because he thinks that revelation of the monotheistic religions was given to everyone. So it establishes a sort of a baseline morality that applies to everyone equally. It's not one person's individual experience or enlightenment versus another person's individual experience or enlightenment. Because that can be tricky to structure a society around or on. So in essence, he claims the Abrahamic religions make it fair. What do you think of this against that?
No, I think that sounds great. And also like this idea of like, spiritual atheism, like you have all of these things about, morality or about working with your consciousness or trying to become a better person, a happier person, whatever. And whatever means that bring you there are great. But the problem with monotheistic religions by definition is that there's three of them and everyone claims to be the right one. Although it's kind of the same God, but this is something which historically led to a lot of violence, which seems to be very problematic if you're trying to use that as a moral, a universal moral matrix for the whole world. Because either you're like, actually, my God is like everyone's God, and you are more open to other religions and like say, oh, that's probably also my God. Or otherwise you run into a problem that at one point it's like, no, but they're the heathens. They have the wrong religion. That's why they have the wrong spirituality. And that's why we need to go to war. I mean, a bit simplistic, but you get what, or that seems for me to be like, the biggest problem if you have these categorical claims, these dogmatic claims, because I very much believe, and this is also from studying science, that reality is postmodern in the sense there is no one objective reality. Reality is this crazy transcendental thing, and you can access it from very different parts, and they all look different, and many of them are valid. It's not just one single way that gets you there. So every claim that says all knowledge is here in this book is futile, and it's going to be doomed. It has to be more open, more plural. It has to be, oh, maybe like these crazy people over there who are like totally wacko and have like this crazy worldview, maybe they have something interesting as well to say. And that's why I kind of like this concept of the mystics, meditators, and psychonauts and shamans, because these are such atypical sources of what you would think where knowledge could come from for Western. But now, like, how many Westerners go to Peru and seek some shaman to like heal me, I have mental health issues?
I heard a lot of these stories, and usually they don't sound very spiritual. Also, people get scammed a lot and stuff. I used to live in Berlin for 10 years, and there was a trend where they would just organize ayahuasca parties in somebody's basement, and then some guy would come over that was supposed to have done it for real in Peru or in South America. And he would just distribute some sort of brew to people, and they would just vomit all over the place. And a lot of people, from what I gather, probably had a pretty bad time and came back in worse shape than when they went in. So,
I mean, that's just so reckless and stupid, because, I mean, that's what the shaman does, kind of hold the space. And like a friend of mine, she's like super psychonaut and always goes to Peru, where she was saying that the person who does the ayahuasca brew, so they also have to like fast and like have no sex and whatever for 3 days before, because otherwise somehow the whole energy mix goes in there and you like kind of feel it. So this is like super high energy stuff where you really need people who understand energies. Like, I don't know, like it's more than just holding an incense stick. So this is the wisdom of the shaman to kind of create this energy field where you can have this experience, have your traumas come up without messing you up even more. And just, having these neo shamans like, hey, in Ibiza, like, hey, I've been to Peru. I'm like certified. I can like do this. So please take this, drink this and give me money or.
Would you say there is like a unifying kind of thread binding most of these experiences, psychedelic experiences that people have together? You know, it's not like one guy's on acid saying, I'm a blue balloon floating into the sky. Another person feels like they're Jesus Christ or whatever. I don't know. But the stories that I hear are wildly different. Would you say there is some sort of undercurrent of, I don't know, being one with everything.
Or just experiencing that your consciousness can access realms of existence which are not bound by space and time. So a lot of these things seem to be happening, like, I mean, at least strong psychedelics or kind of the main ones.
Yeah.
If you take enough, your body is there, closed eyes, and your consciousness is like in some wild other dimension. And the question is this now just something your brain is conjuring up? Although if you measure it, it's not doing much more. It's actually a bit reduced in metabolic activity. Or are you actually accessing a different plane of existence, which has been there and which people have said has been there for ages? So what is it? And people experience as more real, as coming home, which seems weird. So we're not home. And I find that is what is also therapeutic. So when they did LSD trials with terminally ill people, where they have success and people lose a bit of the fear of death because they suddenly realize, hey, what I just experienced now just blew everything I ever believed out of the water. This was just like I have no context or no language to even describe what has happened. So maybe actually all the things I thought aren't conclusive, and there is more to existence than I believe, which then would imply that consciousness maybe isn't something that gets eradicated when your brain stops firing.
You did say that science did figure out, you know, a couple of three things, you know, for 200 years or whatever. So we're making progress. Now we seem to be a bit stuck. How can we bridge? Yeah, science is, of course, we're not going that down that route where, you know, that's prevalent now in the United States, where it's just like people don't believe in you know, that the sky is blue anymore. But how can we bridge now the two? If science is indeed a bit stuck right now, and there's this whole other thing that's going on here when it comes to philosophy of psychedelics and other philosophies and scenarios we could be looking at, how can we connect the two or bridge the two? What do you think is a way out of this?
Scientific spirituality.
Wow. Okay, that's not two words you hear combined very often.
Yeah, they seem to be wrong, but actually maybe they go well together, because on the one hand, you have the rational part, you have the scientific part, you have the technology, you have the understanding of the universe, you know how to cure illnesses, develop vaccines, make the world better. But on the other hand, the thing that seems to be missing in our mass psychosis, apparently on Earth, is that we lack the meaning. And the meaning you can only find through introspection. Meaning is something you find within. Happiness is something you cultivate within. Happiness is not, we know this, happiness doesn't happen if you have a bigger flat, bigger car. It works for a short while and then it sucks and you need more because it's an endless cycle. So the spirituality part is about you being open to working with your consciousness in whatever mean, shape or form, and trying to transform yourself. And I would claim the aim is just to become a happier person, which makes you a better person in society and would make society better if people would be more happy and less outraged, frustrated people. I mean, it seems so sad how many people are just suffering on so many levels, and suffering is something which you can work against. I mean, like this one Tibetan monk, when he was rescued from like 20 years of imprisonment in China, and he was like, the most challenging thing was not to hate the people who were captivating and torturing him. So not to have suffering come up. Or like another example I love, this guy, he went to school with my sister, who's older, where I came from. And then there was an earthquake in Ecuador. And he was like, I'm going to Ecuador to help. And everyone was like, yeah, sure. Well, he stayed there for 20 years. He started building bridges for indigenous communities, like way in the rainforest. he was sponsored by IBM. He got a laptop. He got like plastic contraptions from oil building, whatever corporations that allowed him to build these bridges with the indigenous population. So he was doing this for 20 years in South America. And he gave up his life. He like came back to Switzerland, gave talks, took money, went back. So that was his whole life. Then he was like, hey, there's also people in Asia who probably need help. So he goes to Asia. And what happens? He gets Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is when all your nerves just die. Oof. And I'm reading an article from, hey, Tony El Suizo, how cool, he's in Bangkok. Oh, fuck, he's in hospital. He's writing this article with a pencil in his mouth because he's paralyzed from here. You don't know if it comes back or not. This is Guillain-Barré syndrome. And the guy was writing like, oh, wow. I mean, I lived with poor people for 20 years and I experienced what poverty means. And now every day I'm waking up in a body that's not functioning. What an interesting, interesting experience this is. And this, my body not functioning, has zero influence on the freedom of my mind. And I'm like reading this like, wow, this is possible. I mean, obviously he's like an insane person to be at that level of Zen, but he's not Jesus or whatever. He's a person who you can cultivate, even if you experience suffering, that you react with suffering in your consciousness is something which is potentially optional and you can hold against. And I think that's the spirituality part, that, yeah, that you deal with suffering, and that you, and a big part of spirituality I find is understanding the connectedness of everything, because obviously with your spouse, you're going to be nice to them because they're close to you and your family. But why does it stop there? Why isn't it like all humans? Why isn't it animals? Why isn't it everything that lives that you would totally view with respect and revere? I mean, again, this is cultural. Like in Buddhism, it's like every living being has the same like relevance. And it's not because it's an insect, you just kill it because it's irrelevant. No, every aspect of existence or every living being is part of the same matrix. And if it's idealism, it literally is. It's like same part of this ground field of cosmic consciousness. And I find this would help a lot if people would recognize that it's not like the other is my enemy, or the animal is the thing I use, or plants or whatever. And but that's a, I find that's a spiritual connection you have to like nurture and realize. And even the people you think that suck, you cultivate empathy to understand their perspective and maybe think, if I had those experiences of that person, I would probably be the same, which is kind of humbling because you think, no, I'm so much better. That's such a horrible person. I would never do that. So these are all, but again, in a context of science, so all this misinformation, all these conspiracy theories, all this lying, it's become so normalized to lie. It's crazy. Just any politician can say anything and has no consequences, whatever. All these things should not be possible because truth is such an important, fragile thing, which in a spiritual context, you would never want to not say the truth, or at least 99.9% of the time.
But if the reality is indeed, like you said, postmodern, how can we structure society? Because we're not just by ourselves. So it's kind of equal and fair for everyone. You know, I have my own truth. You have your own truth. They have their own truths. And some people may be view it differently. Some people, if you know, in this instance, can immediately be like, hey, you know, I deserve a little bit more than you and stuff like this. You know, I just feel like we stumble immediately onto this problem.
Yeah.
Should we just spike all of the world's leaders next NATO summit's drinks with a bunch of chemicals and stuff?
Well, maybe we could try.
Yeah, it couldn't be worse.
But just like the respect we have for other people, I mean, this should be something which is also open to more plural thing. And again, it's like, look, my God says this and this, and I believe this and this. And if I'm not saying, but that means that you now have to do this as well. If I cut that part out, I think it becomes a lot easier that everyone does their thing, but they don't impose it on others saying you have to do that because this is the correct thing. If everyone's like, look, this is my thing. It's good for me. I know it's not for everyone. I think that would be already a good start for this more sort of plural experience of being human, or like all these cultural contexts, so random, where you grew up and what you were told and what to believe. And yeah, just being kind of self-aware and trying to be aware of your biases and like the things that, and again, this is for me spirituality, that you're working with yourself. Why did this annoy me? What's with this person? Like, what's on my side that I can learn or do with this? And these are all like little mindfulness things you can do the whole time and not get annoyed and not take it personally. That's, again, the Leela thing. It's, hey, it's a grand play. Let's have fun. It's not personal. It's, you know, it's you having all experiences ever.
How does suffering feature in all this?
In an Asian context, yeah, this Leela recontextualizes suffering because it doesn't exist. It's something that wants to be experienced. Like there's this one guy called Neil Donald Walsh. He, like, back in the day, he wrote 3 books, Conversations with God, where he was like homeless and claimed that one day he sort of said, God, terrible, this is your terrible God, and then like had these conversations in his head where then this God, and it not a Christian or any God, started to like lay out this most optimistic way of looking at things. And there's like one children's book. So there's God in heaven and you have all the little souls and they're like, yay, we're going back to Earth to have experiences because that's this experiential matrix here. That's why we do it, to have these experiences.
Like a video game almost.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
And one soul is like, I would like to experience forgiveness. I want to do that. Like, how does it feel to forgive someone? And then God's like, yeah, no, I can't do that. What? Why can't you do that? And then another soul comes and says, I'll help you. I'll help you. But don't forget, in the next life, when I'm torturing you, to harm you, so you can afterwards forgive me, I'm doing it for you. And I mean, just like these little recontextualizations of the things that happen, like, if there's a bigger picture, if there is more to what's happening, if it isn't all just random and purposeless, then maybe these are things that have a deeper meaning. Or Christopher Bage, the philosopher of religion who took 73 high-dose LSD sessions, did these sessions for 20 years,
yeah,
wrote the book LSD and the Mind of the Universe. The most mind-blowing book ever. Like, deep, for me, that's like the deepest metaphysical like information we have about this sort of transcendental universe. And he has this idea that suffering is like the most noble thing you can do on Earth if you want to help the progression of the divine coming into the physical. Which I was like, whoa, that's wild. That's a wild idea. That's like sort of the tribute, that the suffering is something you offer for making, like, for accelerating the evolution that's happening with this structure forming universe, which apparently has a teleology. It wants to become more complex and, like, maybe in this idealism perspective, incarnate more consciousness from the base layer into the physical. And somehow suffering is something that helps this progress. So again, there's like many ways you can spin this. And again, the suffering and the self, which from an Eastern perspective, the self was always looked a bit at like, yeah, that's not something you should get caught up in. So if you meditate, you kind of have your mind and the thinking and you zoom out and it's not you. And again, like, the self is the thing that's suffering, but that's not you, because you are like, you're the consciousness. And the suffering is happening to the self, which is a construct.
So are we saying in this sort of instance that the brain is more like a receiver
kind of a radio. It tunes into like the base consciousness. That would be the idea.
But and then actually, when people damage their brain or have like a neurological disease, you know, sometimes they completely change their person. Ah, but then if you damage the receiver, then of course you would get a different signal.
One thing is from which I find interesting, David Bergson, he was a philosopher, and he gave the idea to Aldous Huxley when he took mescaline in the 50s, where they claim that consciousness is a valve. It kind of reduces sort of, our brain is a valve that reduces consciousness that flows through it. When you take psychedelics, the valve opens and you get the full flux of transcendental reality, which is bad if you want to survive as a species, because you just, yeah, that's not going to work. You're not going to run away from the saber-tooth tiger. So kind of reducing, and that's why if you damage the brain, you're damaging this reduction valve thing. That's why kind of savants make sense there, because you're kind of taking away part of the restriction and suddenly there's more creativity and more kind of consciousness flowing through. And it's interesting, Stephen Wolfram, the computer science physicist, entrepreneur guy who made millions writing the best mathematical software ever. He wrote a book 20 years ago saying science is wrong with equations. We need algorithms. It's all about algorithms. Now he's back with, and he's like super clever genius guy. And he's now back with a fundamental project, or the project to understand the fundamental theory of physics or something. And where he was saying, look, life, like the whole universe evolving, is computational process. Life is computational. Literally you can compute it, but consciousness isn't. Consciousness is something you have to reduce and compute down again, which sounds really like the reducing valve theory thing. And he comes from it from like a totally different, like whatever, with hypergraphs updating and then claiming that these structures he's seeing explain physics and stuff. And that's kind of what I was doing with the book, like sort of collecting viewpoints of different people that seem to be pointing in the same direction and trying to make a case for that. And so, I mean, it can all be wrong. That's like the uncertainty part, where, I mean, I have to be able to know that I'm wrong. I have to be able to fail. It can't be that my whole identity and self-worth is like fixed in this idea that I have to be right all the time. And if I'm wrong, I don't know.
I have to be right all the time. That's literally me. You're describing me.
That's tough. That's a tough mindset, because I know what you mean, but that's what a lot of us have subconsciously, because we don't want to be wrong and we want to be right because it feels good. And that's why we fight and become so irrational in defending our beliefs, which are often most of the time wrong.
Again, referencing another guest, Philip Goff, I mentioned him in the beginning when we spoke about suffering. His idea is a bit different. He says that he just can't get around the problem of suffering in the universe because it's so bad and so pervasive. So his idea is that there must be, he also believes the universe has a purpose. Mm-hmm. So he comes at it with the idea that there must be a God, but since there's so much suffering, he thinks the God has limited abilities. It's a God that can't prevent or alleviate suffering necessarily.
This sounds very much embedded in sort of a Western Christian.
Yeah, he says he's like a heretic Christian. I think that's what he calls it. That he came to this conclusion now, after just being a panpsychist for a while.
Because a lot of like of these whatever mystics, shamans, meditators, psychonauts, it's like, no, there's like love. Like love is the ultimate thing behind everything. It's like love. So it's not, so consciousness, it's, yeah, the universal consciousness, but that's the wrong definition. It's love. That's what I, like many people have been saying. So maybe, you have to be able to be open to like look deeper into the structure to discover that at the end it's love. And kind of, I don't know, maybe this is just sort of romantic wishful thinking, but it's interesting that there would be like many people having these non-ordinary state of consciousness experiences and like having this very, very profound feeling of love. So yeah, again, having suffering as part of the duality. If you want to have something happen, you need the good and the bad. Otherwise, there's nothing going to happen, left and right. To have the love, you need the suffering. So in this contextual field. And the question again is like, how personal do you take it, suffering? Although it's like super bad and seems to be like, yeah, something that life on Earth has always been struggling with. So yeah, I don't know. I kind of like just sort of recontextualizing, just that there's possibilities of recontextualizing suffering in very, very different ways. If they're right or wrong, who knows? But just it's possible. Suffering isn't something absolute either. So again, there's like multiple ways of addressing the problem of suffering. And especially like, yeah, if there's this divinity and this love, why the hell suffering? But yeah, maybe that's just part of this game that we're in.
What about death then?
So yeah, that isn't a thing in the sense that your consciousness, then if your brain is channeling it, it just goes back into the base consciousness. And then the question is like, how much identity stays, or how much is it like a drop going back into the ocean? Or
I mean, sometimes I'm terrified of this idea that then it's just like one, if it's the case, one big blob of consciousness and we're all one. I don't want to be one with Elon Musk or, you know, somebody shitty like that, like that. You know what I mean? Not to be too egoistical, but you know what I mean? Like, but then you would see I got that, a thing going here.
Elon Musk was just this Muppet, like you were this Muppet. You were playing these roles here. That was not you. That was
the you. But some Muppets are really cool.
But again, you need to have the cool ones to have the not cool ones. But the other thing is like, okay, you die and that was it, and it goes black and nothing was like,
yeah, that's also grim.
Bummer as well. And from kind of a physics informational perspective, that all this consciousness gets created and destroyed seems very much not like how stuff in the universe seems to be conserved all the time.
Okay, that's reassuring.
But again, yeah. Like,
who knows?
And that's probably where sort of, yeah, your intuition, but intuition only works if you kind of are healthy. If you're a narcissist, it's not going to work. Your intuition is going to suck and you're going to come up with very bad conclusions. But if you try and like really sort of get through your own ego and all your issues and try and find out what feels right, what do I believe? I think you probably get a good answer that makes sense to you. And yeah.
Well, I guess we come to the beginning now that my intuition right now is just to scream all the time. But maybe my intuition, you know, because what is all this? You know, molecules, the chair I'm sitting on is made out of molecules and I'm made out of molecules and there's weird stuff happening in the universe. And what the hell am I to make of all this? But maybe that means my pollution is just my intuition, sorry, is just polluted and I'm confused by all of this information that I'm randomly picking off of Wikipedia articles.
have you tried meditation?
Yeah, but I'm really bored.
I can't really access that either, but that's probably like the easiest thing in the sense if you make that a habit for like a couple of months, I'm sure there's like, there's differences that are felt.
I think there's like a million ways
to meditate.
Yeah, I am tempted to go on that. There's a specific strain of meditation where you have to go on a retreat for a while and they just take all of your devices and stuff. I forgot the name. It's quite famous, I think.
Vipassana?
Yeah, exactly. Yes, that's the one. I was tempted by that, but then I get scared. And I heard you have to sit and like I'm really stiff. I'm the anti-yoga person, you know. I wanted to go do yoga once, and one of my female friends was just like, "You're just going to be standing there, like a rock, like a piece of rock, you know. You're not going to be able to like stretch out even." So, I don't know. I heard you have to sit in like a specific position for like hours, and that's just going to kill me.
Challenging, yeah.
Yeah, very challenging. As you can see, I don't like challenges that much.
Well, but you're challenged every day by waking up.
Yeah, exactly. That is a challenge. Yeah. All right. With all that's been said today, during this conversation, what's the best way to live one's life then?
I find just try to become the happy person, a happy person, regardless of like all the bullshit that's going on around you and in the world. Just, yeah, not lose your sense of humor.
Mm.
I find that helps a lot. And that's where I find THC really helps, just not losing my sense of humor in a world I find increasingly insane and like, just what the fuck?
But if you want to pursue this path of, you know, self-discovery while not abandoning, you know, trusting in science and stuff, how would you begin this path?
I never really thought about that. That's a good question.
Yeah.
But I think it's about like putting your attention more towards you, like not running after something outside, like be it some fad or some guru or some technology or some whatever, but just trying to like deal more with your own consciousness. Like, this is the crazy thing. This is the thing that gives you access to everything. That's your being. That's the thing. That's the only thing you can work with, like, directly. Everything else is then an extension of your consciousness. So, depending on like what you like or not, there's many traditions, old traditions, new traditions, which give you ways to this. And again, the plurality, there's probably one way which you maybe resonate with.
James, thank you so much for taking the time. This was a mind-blowing, mind-bending conversation. But
no, thank you very
there was
much.
So much stuff, but I feel like we could, you know, we just scratched the surface. So we have to do this again. I hope you're up for it. Where can people find your book?
So I've been having problems there, unfortunately.
Oui.
Amazon.com, but Amazon EU stopped shipping it for some reason.
So, hopefully because so many copies were sold.
No, they just took it out of the catalog, and I talked to the publisher, and they were like, hey, we have no influence over Amazon. They don't even answer our emails. And it was like, again, the universe just did its thing. So I had a book launch, and until the day of the book launch, I could order the book from Amazon EU, be it DE or .co.uk. The day after the book launch, you couldn't order it anymore. Oh. So all of my friends were like, where do I get the book? I'm like, the online. They're like, no. I'm like, sure. And they're like, what? So... yeah, but probably some seller will stock it up and it should become available. So if you're, I don't know, can you get it to Japan?
I'll check, because you did send me the copy. So I didn't try to order it. But I think I could. Last time I checked, I think it should be okay.
Yeah. It's so wild that now you're just dependent on some corporations, which... just you cannot talk to.
If Jeff Bezos is going to space that week, maybe your book is going to be shipped.
And they're like, the algorithm says, no, this book will take it out. Then, like, your whole career dies.
By the way, where do you think this whole AI craze is going to go? Because it's getting a tiny bit frightening.
I mean, that's like the thing. Do you believe that consciousness is done by the brain? Because then it's like, AI, it's come on. It's just like, it's just pattern recognition. It's just software. Or you're like, does the universe build stuff that can channel consciousness like our brains? And now our brain builds stuff that's also super complex that maybe starts to channel consciousness. And then we have conscious AI. That would seem to be, if idealism is correct, that seems to be an option there, that this stuff suddenly develops an inner perspective
maybe.
So you think with increasing complexity, that's how consciousness might appear?
I mean, you need the receiver, the radio. Yeah. And this has to be complex enough to tune in. So our brains do that. And maybe at one point our software is like doing the same thing. Like the complexity does not have to be like organic.
I see. Yeah.
But I'm really hopeful because of, at least until now, it seemed to be that AI is like pretty much just taking in all the information.
stealing all the information, you know, a lot of the times.
Stealing all the information.
Yeah.
But at least it's giving you a view which isn't hyper, like, like this ideology warfare we're in, like these ideological trench wars, this my team, your team, left, right.
Oh, you're talking about Twitter. Red,
everything, everywhere is just like, it's so bad, this division in society, and like literally each part lives in a different universe they perceive. And I believe AI at the moment still can like bridge this sort of, it can give you a more neutral and unbiased view on stuff. But again, I'm sure the people with ideological interests will soon give us IA that's highly ideological, and then that's done as well. But just like now, if I have conversations with AI about idealism, it gives me like, it's crazily nuanced and like open if you start to like challenge and discuss with it, which is interesting because idealism must be such a tiny, tiny subset of all the data, which is basically framed in a physicalist, materialist, metaphysical
perspective
context.
Yeah.
So I find it really interesting that it's still like, ah, okay, that's true. And these are the problems. And this here doesn't fit in so well. And I really like that because such conversations are not possible with humans who have invested in some idea. And they're going to defend their idea, whatever.
Yeah, I'm just more worried again on this sort of societal level that AI is going to take all the cool jobs, all the creative jobs that we actually really want. And we're going to be left to sweep the streets and, you know, and do everything that we hoped AI would actually do.
But it goes back further, like in the 30s, Keynes, the economist, he wrote that his grandchildren would be about now, we'll be living in a world where we work like 5 hours a week or something because everything is automatized and you can just do the things you want to. And like,
it's not going society. Quite like that.
And we automatize everything. And now we have even AI doing that, but we all have to work more and have like two jobs to sustain. So something went terribly wrong. So the idea that we have technology that takes away the edge and this kind of survival stuff, and we could start to just be more dealing with the things that drive us and be more creative. And I think, so there's like the horrible worldview that, oh, people are lazy. And if you just give them like universal basic income, if you just give them money, they'll just be lazy and take drugs, which is actually not true because that sounds we pretty know good, that, actually. That, yeah, no, but most people are purpose driven. They want to do something with their life. They don't want to just hang around and take drugs or not work. They want to be creative in their own unique way. And I find if we allow technology to take away the mundane stuff, which should also be sweeping the streets, and open up for people to somehow survive on doing the thing that they are passionate about, I think that would be transformative as well. But I don't know how you like pay rent. I mean, like with the book, this is a hobby. There's no way I can live from writing books. It's like music.
Yeah.
1% has all the income and everyone else. Yeah.
No, so, I agree. But I also think that if people just want to have interesting thoughts and hang out, that's also not a problem. I think we can accommodate everybody. We have so much stuff. But, and
but it was more sort of the idea that if you give people money, then they just, the worst comes out in them. And that's just not true. That, I mean, that happens to a small percentage, obviously. But I think psychology shows us for most people, it's like, no, I want to do something.
And now we're doing the opposite. Let's try to make the most horrible possible thing and see if people are suddenly going to become like good and compassionate towards each other. Anyway, James, I took up a lot of your time. Thank you so much. Thanks again.
That was awesome. Thank you so much.
Absolute pleasure. And yeah, likewise. By the way, do you have any social media that you want to shout out?
I mean, I have like everything and it's
okay.
I
don't know. All right. We'll just Google you.
I know.
We have to play this dirty, dirty game. Thanks again, James. For listening, please subscribe to the podcast on YouTube, follow on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. I've been told on countless YouTube tutorials that I have to say this, otherwise nothing happens, which is strange. Also, if you feel like it, support me on Patreon. I'm playing the world's smallest violin here, but this is a one-person pod. I have no production team, no nothing. So feel free to hop on Patreon and find Smart Cookies on there. And then last but certainly not least, I have to thank my existing patrons, Tovarishi and Tovarishitsa. Without you, this podcast simply would not exist. So thank you so much. That makes you actual producers of this show. So eternal thanks to Darey, Roktoržan, Sasha Vipotnik, Neven Cvijanović, Juš Premrov, Nate Sirp, Goran Ivašić, Anže Sever, Ole, Marin Ferrara, Dejan Žulnir, Aljaš Maher, Štrole, Ajda Mancian, Miha Medved, Medinjo, Goran, Gordon, Lorenzo, Jurečuk, Mila, Carmen, Veronika, and Taichi. You guys rock. Thank you so much.